Well, it's the end of the season for the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, and it will go out with a primitivist bang on Friday night. That's tomorrow night in Miller Auditorium. The concert is called Bartok and Stravinsky, and we're here with assistant conductor Daniel Breyer, possibly the KSO's MVP of the season. He's a fabulous conductor, but also preparing pieces, understanding the music. And Daniel, although you won't be conducting, you're here to talk about the fantastic histories of the Bartok and Stravinsky. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And we have the soloist for tomorrow night's concert, Corey Zaravsek, who is a Canadian born violinist and someone special to my personal history. I got to see you perform, Corey, when I was about 8 or 9 years old up in northern Canada, and it's so great to see you here in person, and I'm very excited to learn about what you've been up to lately and about your approach to this masterpiece by Béla Bartók. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks.
So the season really is going out with an amazing 20th century teeth bared. Let's really, you know, demolish this concert kind of attitude. Although I think we'll discover there are moments of great beauty and solace even in some of the pieces. But could we start at the very beginning of this concert, Daniel? There's a piece I haven't mentioned yet.
Yes, we opened the program with Jennifer Higdon's Machine. And she basically, when she was writing Machine, she was thinking about all the composers that came before and seemed to be able to write just note after note after note as if they were machines. And it's a great little way to open the concert. About 2.5 minutes of just constant movement in the orchestra. And so it's like a perpetual motion in the orchestra, and it builds to this great big giant climax at the end. And it's a great way to open a program like this that has a lot of fireworks all throughout.
Like a machine, does it require all the players to sort of play their act as little pistons, or do their part?
Generally, if you're in the orchestra for this piece, you have a little rhythmic cell or a group of notes that you're just repeating over and over, and then she moves up a pitch or two and then up again. Then the trombones get these giant swells and slides. They get to show off these, you know, it really shows off the brilliance of the orchestra.
Jennifer Higdon is a woman composer, so it's great you're featuring her, and she's a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer. When did the idea of machinery creep into classical music?
That's a good question. I think many composers at different points had thought of it. You have, like, Beethoven 8. There's a whole movement that has the tick-tock of a metronome, which was a brand-new machine from his time. Onegger wrote this really great piece about a train. Flight inspired many great composers. I think probably the piece that we'll talk about later, the Stravinsky, The Rite of Spring, has certain elements to it that are quite mechanistic that composers like Dmitri Shostakovich took up much later. And so actually the relation with music and machines is quite strong for over a century.
Yeah, and longer. I didn't even think about the Beethoven.
Yeah.
The concert again is 8 o'clock on Friday night in Miller Auditorium. Will there be a concert prelude? A little in-depth discussion.
Yes, starting at 7 p.m. we have the Wiser Financial Prelude talk, and it's a time to come and just get a little bit more of the historical context and get yourself acquainted with the music you're about to hear.
Will there also be an opportunity afterward this time? There's been occasions this season to mingle.
Right. Not at the end of this one.
Okay.
I think there's plenty of fireworks, and I think everyone will be very exhausted by the end. So.
Or energized.
Yes.
The musicians may be tired, but I've found that this kind of music will leave me on a huge high, just like... I feel like I just had a bucket of coffee.
Yes.
So, Corey, let me ask you to fill in a whole bunch of years, I guess. When I first saw you, you were probably I think you're a bit younger than me, actually, so maybe I'm getting my timeline wrong, but you were probably a preteen and already in giving public concerts frequently. Growing up in Vancouver?
That's right. So my parents emigrated from Austria, and I was born in Vancouver. Grew up in Canada. Left when I was 12 to go study in Indiana at Indiana University in Bloomington. Wonderful professor by the name of Joseph Gingold, who's kind of, very famous in the violin world. He taught an immense number of students.
That's right.
Who have spread all over the musical world. And then in my late teens, got a manager in New York, started playing a lot of concerts. Spent a good chunk of my life doing that. Then some twists and turns. I decided at one point to move to France. Ended up spending 10 years in Paris, kind of on the sly. I never officially resided there, but now I mention this. during which time, I had also studied mathematics when I was at Indiana, and that bug never really went away. And so it's a long story that's hard to explain, but somehow I ended up starting a startup company, actually, in medical education over the web with some friends in California. So while I was in Paris, I was doing that, and I kind of got into the software business and never stopped playing violin, but just reduced the number of concerts because they were saying, you got to be here, you know, we got to spend time with the engineers.
Yeah, that's an intense situation.
So then I was in the Bay Area for a little while, lived in Portland, Oregon for a bit. Then what else? Was recently teaching. Just thought I should try that out at some point since teaching has been a constant in my life. Earlier has been the influence of great teachers. Somebody was on sabbatical up at University of British Columbia in Vancouver. So I went back to Vancouver for the first time in many decades.
Oh, wow.
Or I should say I had been back for concerts, but to live actually for a couple of months. And that's about it. I was just I was in Portugal a couple of weeks ago, and Julian Querti is an old friend since probably also 10 years at least.
That's what I was going to ask you about, how you crossed paths with Julian Querti, who is a Torontonian, I think, originally. Also born to immigrant parents.
Right? Yeah. Julian and I actually know each other through a mutual musician friend in Boston who introduced us at some point, and then we worked together in Montreal. He's been based in Montreal for a long time.
That's right.
I worked with the Montreal Symphony up there, and then he and I also did some concerts down in South America, which was great fun. We've been in Chile a few times together. I was expecting to see him this fall in Peru, which is where we're doing Brahms Concerto in Lima, but then I was in Portugal a few weeks ago, and he called me and said, would you by any chance be available to play Bartok's second? Because we're missing a soloist or
along
those lines.
The scheduled soloist had an injury, which happens. And then Corey, you came in to save the day.
We'll see about that. I'm working on it.
How was your Bartok second concerto feeling? I mean, when you're asked to play a major, this is a nearly 40-minute piece. It's not something you can always have immediately ready to go.
I have to admit, actually, I equivocated about it at first because there are a lot of concerti which one plays a lot. You know, there's Mendelssohn and Tchaikovsky and Beethoven and Brahms and those kinds of things. You could probably wake me up in the middle of the night and shuffle me on a stage and I'd start playing. Bartok's second, honestly, I performed once 20 years ago. So it's not exactly something that was in my fingers. And when Julian first called me, I said, well, check if you can find somebody else because I just kind of went on vacation a few days ago. And he pestered me a little bit. And then I said, well, let me look at the music and just see how hard I think it would be to get this back in my fingers. And inevitably realized, well, this is actually really cool.
It's
I remember
awesome
this is a cool piece.
Yeah.
Okay, this seems like a nice thing to do for
it's
an unexpected detour, but
it got under your skin. You're like, yes, I can see myself doing this.
I can see this happening. I also just like pushing myself once in a while, so it's a bit of a wild and crazy thing.
Fantastic. Bartok was it was 1936. I've got some info here. When he wrote to his music publisher and asked the publisher, please send me some contemporary violin concertos. I'm kind of interested in checking them out. Mm-hmm. And he received a Szymanowski, Berg, and Kurt Weill.
Ah.
And looked at these scores, and then the wheels started turning.
Yeah.
It was still a couple years before this piece was ready. But it's so interesting to me that a composer starts off by saying, can I have a look at what's happening mm-hmm. right now?
Check out the competition.
Yeah. And Daniel, since you've been studying this piece too, can you give us a little more context about Béla Bartók and what point in his career maybe he was at?
Well, this was a later work of his. It's actually the second concerto, because there was one that he wrote earlier, the first violin concerto, which was not really known in his lifetime mainly. And so that's why it's the second concerto. But at the time, this was the Bartók violin concerto, when it came out. And it's just a fantastic piece. I mean, the music is, it's emotional, but there's so much depth, and the way he constructs it is so exquisite, what he does during it. I'm sure you can talk about it. I mean, you only have to listen a few seconds before you hear the soloist come in, and then the soloist just takes you on this incredible journey all the way to the end.
It is a fantastically well-constructed piece. I think this was one of the things that drew me into it when I was looking at the score again, because I was talking about this with Julian, saying, I don't know if it's also because of the years in between when I was into computer programming and such, but I don't remember when I performed this, the one time that I performed this 20 years ago, that I had been as intrigued by how it's constructed on the note level. Music theorists talk about pitch sets and such, but there are these little patterns, and there's actually quite a lot of tactile pleasure in playing it also, because your hands form these patterns. And it's not, musically, it's constructed quite differently from the tonal music that's such a mainstay of our repertoire. And yet it has this very compelling logic. And I don't really know what it feels like to be the audience listening to this when you haven't spent as much time with it. But I suspect that I'd like to think that it communicates, even if it's going by really fast, because a lot of these patterns are happening quite quickly. But they're just really cool. They're like little tile pieces that kind of fit together.
Are you talking about simply looking at the solo part, or did you also acquire a full score and have a look at some of how it all fits together?
I do some of each. I mean, you have to know what's going on in the orchestra as well as the soloist to fit things together. But there are a lot of notes in the solo parts. So I will not not claim to know the orchestra score in anywhere near as much detail as the solo part.
Can you follow up on the ideas that Bartók is using, these gestures?
Well, he was very interested in mathematics, and much of his music, if you really spend a lot of time studying it, there's a lot of math involved, a lot of stuff that he does with numbers. And in fact, he was very inspired by lots of different things, like the Fibonacci sequence, and you find that in some of his music. I think what's interesting to me about this particular piece is the idea of variation, because the second movement is really a theme in variations, maybe the best set of theme and variations that he wrote in all of his repertoire. But even the first movement and the last movement itself is a sort of variation on some of the musical ideas of the first movement. And so I think one of the things that holds it together, even though he doesn't have the same tonal music that that maybe Brahms or Beethoven would have been writing in, it's so logically held together by all of these patterns and all of these, and even just some of the sonorities that he chooses, like the harp itself has such a beautiful sonority, and you hear that, and then you hear the soloist enter right away. He's really thinking, I think, of the listener. And so underneath the surface, there's all of that happening. But really, as a listener, you get to really just enjoy this really emotional and quite beautiful music.
Yeah, the great composers, you can feel at home in their world. They create their own space and their own universe that you can't see the flaws in. You can't say, well, this is shoddy construction. It's one of the joys of being an audience member, actually.
Yes.
To be placed in the hands of a great, great thinker, a great composer. We need to preview a little bit of this music, get a taste of it out there for our listeners. I want to remind listeners the concert will be held tomorrow at Miller Auditorium at 8 p.m. with a 7 p.m. prelude for those of you who want some more context and some well-thought-out remarks on both pieces. The Stravinsky Rite of Spring is coming up too, so I'll be talking about that. But let's hear the opening of the Bartok Violin Concerto No. 2. We have a Christian Tetzlaff recording here from the library, the London Philharmonic, led by Michael Gielen. We have to say goodbye in the middle of the movement from the Concerto No. 2 by Béla Bartók, a 1938 premiere and the season finale of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, which will be held tomorrow at 8 p.m. Corey Sarovsek is the soloist, and he's here in the studio with me, along with assistant conductor Daniel Breyer. Julian Querty can't be here today, but he will be on the podium tomorrow to conduct this work and The Rite of Spring, as by Stravinsky and Jennifer Higdon's Machine. If you tuned in during the music, let me recap a few highlights. Corey and Julian actually go back. Both are Canadian and have been friends for quite a while, similar generation. And so when Susie Park was unable to be here for this concert due to an injury, Julian called Corey and had to twist his arm a little bit, because this is a major, major piece and you just don't take it on lightly, right?
Right, which is why I took it on lightly.
But as we listen to the music, you're fully enjoying the piece, like hearing all the parts and smiling at the parts that you and Julian have talked about, and it's the more you hear it, the better it gets.
It really is a great piece. I mean, there's this lovely combination of there are very exciting and muscular portions, but a lot of it's very lyrical as well.
Yeah, I was noticing that.
And as I'm one of those classical musicians who always envies jazz musicians, because they seem to always have the best harmonies. They got all these extended extended tertians, we call them. And Bartók also not tonal in a traditional fashion, but there are so many cool chords in there. It's really fun to play. Just these kind of dissonances you get and moments of consonance as well. So really great stuff.
And Daniel, would you speak to how the orchestra handles this part of their part of the concerto?
Well, this is a difficult concerto to put together with the orchestra, because the orchestra is treated quite... They're given quite a lot to play in this particular concerto. And also, it's not a concerto that comes by quite often. So for like Beethoven or Tchaikovsky or Brahms or even Sibelius, they come by frequently enough that everyone can rely on their muscle memory to really kind of get it back in the fingers. But this one, I know from talking with my colleagues, they got the music and, oh, we got to look at this. And they're doing a wonderful job putting it together, and it's a lot of fun. Even though it's work, it's a lot of fun to put together.
The next big work on the program is Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Other than the fact that Bartok and Stravinsky were contemporaries, is there anything in their different universes that kind of overlap or come together or sympathize?
Well, I think with the Rite of Spring in particular, some of the big textures that Stravinsky builds play a lot with numbers as well. So I think that's one area where there's a direct connection. Mm-hmm. There's some sections where Stravinsky has these ostinatos, which is a repeated musical figure, usually a rhythm, but sometimes a little melodic cell. And he'll layer several different ostinatos that have different numbers of beats to them, like 7 and 9 and 11. And then what he'll do is that when all of the ostinato patterns line up at the same time, something big and explosive happens, or in one spot, there's literally silence. And so I think that would be, if I were to think of a direct connection right now, it would be both of their ability to play around with numbers and music.
Well, let's get into the Rite of Spring a little bit. This is a ballet, originally, 1913. What is strange to me is that today it is, for such a famous piece, we have a lot of trouble accessing how the original production looked and sounded. Why can't I just find it the ballet danced all the time?
Well, it's an interesting and long and twisted story with the ballet and the choreography in particular. Probably even too long to reduce it all into one, you know, like 2-minute discussion. However, what I will say is that the original choreography, when the ballet came out and when it was first performed, first of all, there were 17 orchestra-only rehearsals, followed by 5 rehearsals with the dancers. So you're already over 20 rehearsals. What's amazing is that now orchestras pull it off in 4 rehearsals or less today. But at the time, the music was just so far ahead of its time and so unlike anything before that they needed all of that time to put it together. And then throughout the course of the actual ballet, there were a couple different choreographers that took it up. There was also, as you can imagine, dealing with artists and impresarios, there was much personal problems that crept in, and so that's why the original choreography it's harder to come across, because at one point Stravinsky and the original choreographer had a falling out, and I think there was a marriage of, you know, one person to the impresario, that there was another falling out between the choreographer and the impresario. So it's one of those, I'm sure it would be a great opera plot line.
Yes.
But it's a very interesting story.
One thing throughout Igor's life, he had trouble getting paid.
Yes.
And he, because of copyright law in all these different countries he lived in, and he himself tried to figure out a way to handle this system by creating different versions of his music. What is the common version the most of this ballet?
Well, I forget the date. I think it's 1947, I think, is the most, what most people regard as the accepted version. It's probably, in fact, I don't know if any of the other ones are performed much, if at all, today. Mm-hmm. And it was retypeset, I think, in the 60s. So with this particular piece, there are fewer different versions that are in performance. With the Firebird and with Petrushka, there are multiple performances of different editions still to this day.
Okay, you have many to choose from.
Yes.
Another image that comes to mind, besides the dancers and their unusual costumes, is that Igor was the rehearsal pianist even before they got into rehearsing with the orchestra. So he's in the studio banging out this music and having probably a lot of people look at him going, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Where's this? Why is the beat there?
There are so many contemporaneous accounts of people in that process, of the rehearsal process, also of people that he played some of the music for on the piano, and generally all of them, without exception, maybe a few exceptions, it was just like, what is that? What is this? This is something that no one really had the ability to comprehend at the time.
Well, we should talk about his inspiration, because he had a very specific kind of storyline in mind.
Yeah, I mean, the scenario itself is if you're looking for some kind of wholesome entertainment, that Friday night's not the night. I mean, this is there's an abduction, there's human sacrifice. This is a pagan, it's a rite, a Russian rite of spring, and he was very interested in bringing this old Russian feeling to Paris at the time. And what's interesting to me is just how the orchestra becomes something so different than anything before it, that really all the composers that came after Rite of Spring assembled the pieces in a different way. It's almost like this giant explosion happened, and all of these composers that came after had to come up with a new way of working with the orchestra as an organism. It's quite amazing.
It begins with a bassoon solo. What do you think that solo evokes for you?
Well, I think it's a way of just setting the stage. And he puts the bassoon so high in the register, so high that the original bassoonist had the very, very difficult time even executing what he wrote. And then it literally takes you into this whole nother world immediately, just because of the sonority that instrument creates when it's so high.
I think I read once about someone said that it feels like after a frozen winter, maybe the ice is starting to crack.
That's a great image. Yeah.
We're going to take a break now. I've been speaking with Daniel Breyer, the assistant conductor of the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra, who recently came back from Detroit after conducting a Detroit Symphony family concert there, and our soloist for Friday, Corey Saravsek, who will perform in the Bartok Concerto, but that seems to have know your Stravinsky pretty well too, and enjoy this piece as well.
I have happy flashbacks, because this it's a work that when you study music, you're introduced to it.
That's right.
In music school,
it's as groundbreaking as it gets.
Probably first learned about it when I was 10 or 11, and then again at the university. And so
it's a lifetime piece. So for all listeners who haven't had the pleasure of hearing it in a live concert, your chance is tomorrow, 8 o'clock at Miller Auditorium. Here's that famous opening, and we'll listen to an unusual recording. This is a student performance at the New England Conservatory, but it has that iconoclastic composer and conductor at the helm, Gunther Schuller. Very hard to find a place to fade out of the Rite of Spring. It's all just exhilaratingly intense. So if you tuned in during the music, that was a section of the Rite of Spring, the famous ballet by Igor Stravinsky, and it will wrap up the season of the Kalamazoo Symphony tomorrow night, along with Béla Bartók's Concerto No. 2. Two early 20th century masterpieces and a chance to hear them live, which doesn't come along very often. So I'm with Daniel Breyer, who is the assistant conductor of the KSO. Now, I know Julian is on the podium tomorrow, Julian Quarty, the new music director. What is the extent to which you study scores, even though you're not necessarily going to be on the podium with the KSO?
Well, as when you're cover conducting, which is what we call it, you're during the rehearsal process, you're there to help with balances in the hall and listening and an extra set of ears for the conductor, which is always nice to have. You have to be prepared in case some, natural disaster occurs and you have to step up there, and then sometimes you have to. But I think for me, the fun thing with a program like this is Rite of Spring is a work that I've done before, and I also studied it in school. In conducting school, if Rite of Spring is like, it's one of the hardest things to actually conduct in all of the orchestral repertoire. And so that's a work that I learned in graduate school, and then I've conducted it before. So it's always fun to return to something like this and explore and see how Julian does it, because there are so many different ways to solve the problems of the score. And so it's always a fun process for me.
After having learned how to conduct the Rite of Spring, does the next assignment seem pretty easy?
If you can conduct Rite of Spring, you probably can conduct most things because of the difficulty for the orchestra. There's this one moment that I always love, and it's in part two, and you feel the music kind of starting to meander, and then we're right before the very end, and we have the sacrificial dance, which is, and there's something that happens every single time I've ever been to a performance or been on the stage playing it or conducting it, and it's like you just feel every single person in the room with their attention just drawing in what's going to happen. Then you get to the sacrificial dance, and it's exhilarating because on the stage, you can't let your focus, wander for even a split second, because it's so difficult to pull off. So everyone on the stage, all the musicians, have the most focus that they can bring, and the conductor, and it just brings the audience in, and then it ends in this just spectacular way. There's something really spectacular about that, and it's something I always love.
Could we talk about all the instruments he required? This is almost a concerto for orchestra, because everybody is playing at the top of their levels.
Well, we even augmented the string section, adding an extra desk to each section of the strings.
Because a desk? What does a desk mean?
a desk or a stand, which would be two players. So in the violin section, we added two, and in second violins, likewise. Mm-hmm. And then he asks for quite a lot of percussion. Actually, not as much as one would think with how explosive this piece is, but quite a lot of percussion. The timpanis, there's two timpanists and a number of drums on the stage, so that's always fun to watch. And then if you look in the woodwind section, you'll see winds by five. So there's at least five wind players in the flute section and the oboe. So you get to hear all of the instruments from alto flute to piccolo to bass clarinets to E-flat clarinets, bass trumpet, piccolo trumpet. There's two tubists. It's just a spectacular thing. It's amazing.
Oh, it makes me want to just wander among the musicians and check out all their instruments, what they're playing.
Although the stage is so full, you wouldn't have space to wander.
This is going to be a fantastic finale to the season. And here at the end of our hour, perhaps you could maybe tell us what you're looking forward to in season 99. It's online right now at KalamazooSymphony.com. Season subscriptions available too, of course, KalamazooSymphony.com.
Well, we have so many great performances next year. I'm in particular looking forward to Mahler, the Song of the Earth, St. Matthew's Passion, Ravel, Daphnis, and Chloe. In my symphonic series, I'm really excited to introduce a piece by Ligeti that many people won't know, but it's an early work of his, and it's Concert Romanesque, and it's fantastic. It's an amazing piece. We also have a lot of collaborations for our family, programming with the Air Zoo for a really cool piece by Philip Glass called Icarus at the Edge of Time.
Ooh.
And we have, there's so many, we have great movies too. We have E.T., How to Train Your Dragon, and the last of our Star Wars installment. So there's just so much incredible music. Every single program has something amazing in it.
Just, and the fact that it's live and
yes.
here in Kalamazoo is so amazing, and we're so lucky to have this ensemble in its 99th season.
99th season.
Getting started next fall. You'll hear lots more about it here on WMUK, and I'm really grateful to have access to artists like yourself, Daniel Breyer, and our guest soloist for tomorrow, Corey Sarovsek. Thank you both for being here to talk about this concert.
Thanks for having us.